On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, known as ITRC, welcome to today's PFAS Roundtable Session 1, Naming Conventions, Sampling and Analytical Approaches, and History and Sources. My name is Kate Emma Closher, and I'm joining today's webinar from New Hampshire. Our training today is sponsored by ITRC and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Today, I'm going to introduce ITRC and the ITRC PFAS resources that are available to you on the ITRC website, and then I'm going to review some housekeeping related to the format for today's roundtable. Next, I'll review a few highlights of today's subject matter, and then we're going to move into the question and answer portion with our expert panelists. ITRC is a program of the Environmental Council of the State, known as ECOS. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 individual members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating in today. ITRC's goal is to advance the use of innovative environmental technologies and approaches. ITRC's work translates good science into better decision-making. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website. On the website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you use ITRC materials, we do ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. Please note that neither ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material or endorse any specific products. Earlier this year, ITRC published a several hundred page per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances technical and regulatory guidance document, updated a series of fact sheets with supporting documentation, and prepared 10 training video modules on the content of the guidance document. These resources were prepared by a team comprised of more than 500 professionals. The current PFAS team leaders are Bob Mueller with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection and myself from the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. I'm going to serve as the moderator for today. Before we get started, I just want to go over a few housekeeping items. Today's session is scheduled for a little more than 2 hours. All participants, other than the panelists, will be on mute, and you'll stay on mute for the duration of the roundtable. This event is being recorded for you to access at a later time on the CLUIN training page. If you'd like a copy of the slides, you can download them from the initial CLUIN training page you were directed to today. You can also access the slides by going to the related link section, clicking on the CLUIN training page, and then clicking the Browse To button. If you have technical difficulties, you can try to request support using the Q&A pod on your screen. Lastly, at the end of the session today, please provide your thoughts about today's roundtable on the online feedback form. This will help us improve in future sessions. In addition, by completing this feedback form, you'll be able to certify that you participated today, and a certificate of attendance can be issued to you. I'd like to briefly go over our new roundtable format and explain how you can actively participate. Please note that this is a brand new type of session for ITRC, and we know it won't be perfect, but we have had overwhelming interest, and we really do appreciate the support from you, our participants, and we welcome your feedback at the end of the session. Today, I'm going to read the questions, and the panelists will provide their responses. We're going to start with questions submitted by you, our participants, and advance during registration. We will also include some questions that we receive from our team members and some attendees at prior ITRC PFAS training classes. However, at any time today, please feel free to ask additional questions using the Q&A pod on the bottom of your screen. We're going to try and answer as many of the questions as we can in this session, although it may not be possible to answer all questions during the live webinar. But to that end, we plan to prepare a digest of the questions and answers, along with a reference to the information in the guidance document, which will be made available in the weeks after the webinar. Today's roundtable addresses questions focused on three main topics: naming conventions, sampling techniques and analysis procedures, and the history of the uses of PFAS as well as sources of PFAS released to the environment. Future roundtables will address questions related to other topics from the PFAS technical and regulatory guidance documents. If you have questions about those other topics, please provide those questions on the feedback form, and please accept our invitation to join us for our future PFAS roundtables. Also, with the ever-emerging science around PFAS, the ITRC PFAS team plans to update the guidance document over the next year and a half. If you've submitted a question that isn't addressed in the current document, please note that our PFAS team plans to consider addressing that information as feasible in the upcoming revisions. As indicated in the registration materials, today's conversation is intended to address specific questions about the content in the guidance document and training materials, with the expectation the participants are familiar with the content. If you want to navigate to the online resources during today's discussion, there is a link to the ITRC PFAS webpage in the related links pod. Before we start, I'd like to go over a few items for today's discussion, starting with highlights of naming conventions. On your screen, you can see a simplified PFAS family tree. This family tree shows how the thousands of chemicals known as PFAS can be categorized. This grouping represents the naming conventions applied for consistency in the ITRC guidance materials, although we note that other entities might use other approaches. To begin with, the large family of PFAS can be divided into two primary classes, polymers and non-polymers. In most cases, our main concern is with the non-polymer side of the PFAS family tree. Some of the non-polymer polyfluoroalkyl substances and a small subset of polymer PFAS may degrade to form perfluorinated PFAS. Due to the differences among these chemicals and how they behave in the environment, it's extremely important to be both clear and specific in our descriptions. Next, we'll highlight a few items for sampling and analysis. As many of you are likely already aware, PFAS sampling is different from other sampling events. This difference is due to an increased potential for contamination to occur during sample collection, shipping, or storage because of the wide use of PFAS and the very low action limits for PFAS projects. This increased contamination risk requires PFAS-specific sampling and analysis plans, along with an increase in communication with our laboratories. There are multiple methods published or under development for PFAS analysis, but the scope of these methods can vary greatly, and there are significant differences between each method. Some of these differences include the sample preparation process, the analyte list, and the quantitation scheme. It's important to be aware of these differences so that the method selected can be used to meet the data quality objectives of a particular project. There are also less standardized approaches that can be used for qualitative and screening tools. And lastly, to highlight some history and sources information. PFAS has been produced on a commercial scale since the 1950s. Even though PFAS have been used and continue to be used today in a wide range of applications, the documentation in the public realm does not specifically identify which of the thousands of PFAS are used in which applications. In the early 2000s, efforts began in the U.S. and elsewhere to phase out production of certain PFAS that were thought to be the most potentially harmful to human health and the environment. However, there are some exceptions for continued limited uses of some of these chemicals, and much of the production simply shifted to other parts of the world. Other PFAS have since been introduced as replacements. PFAS have been released to the environment from many types of sources, but the potential for significant impact can vary based on the type and magnitude of the release and the types and concentrations of PFAS associated with that release. Some of the sources with the potential for releases are associated with industrial facilities that produce PFAS or process PFAS, or facilities that use PFAS in manufacturing or other activities. There's the use of industrial products, including fluorine-containing Class D firefighting foams and use of consumer products. And there's also related activities where PFAS-containing wastes are managed, which might include landfills and areas where wastewater treatment residuals are managed. So next, it's my pleasure to introduce our expert panelists. All of them have been active members of ITRC's PFAS team over the years. They've dedicated many hours to develop the PFAS guidance document, and they've supported or served as volunteer trainers for ITRC. A very special thank you to all of our panelists for participating today. Our panelists are Jeff Wenzel from the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services, Liz Denley of TRC Environmental, Bob Buck from Chemours, Janice Willey of the Navy, and Chuck Neslin from Eurofin. If you'd like to read more about their areas of expertise, you can access their bios from the CLUIN training page in the related link pod on your screen. So with that, we're going to move into the heart of today's agenda, which is the roundtable question and answers. At any time, you can type your question in the Q&A pod at the bottom of your screen. We're going to try to get through as many of the questions as we can. And just one reminder, we are focusing on the content in the guidance document. So unfortunately, we won't be able to address questions that are outside the scope of the current guidance document. We do have a few slides we pulled together to help support some of the questions we received, so we are planning to flip between those during the roundtable based on the questions that we received today. Okay, so we are going to start actually with Liz Denley. Liz, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. So Liz, the first question says, is there a convention for pronunciation of PFAS? I sometimes hear PFAS, but sometimes people use PFAS to differentiate from similar sounding PFOS, or I guess as I say it, I guess other people say PFAS, or I say PFOS.
Thanks, Kate, Emma. So this is a relatively easy but very important question because surprisingly, some of the PFAS acronyms are very commonly mispronounced, which can make communication about these chemicals sometimes even more confusing. So if you like pronouncing the acronyms, the two most commonly mispronounced acronyms are PFAS, P-F-A-S, which are the group of chemicals we are discussing today, and PFOS, P-F-O-S, which is just one of thousands of PFAS chemicals. And sometimes it could just be a matter of which part of the country you're from as to how these acronyms are pronounced or mispronounced. So I would say that if we had to pick a convention for the pronunciation of PFAS, it may be easiest if we just universally try and spell them out when we are discussing them and say PFAS and PFOS so we are not potentially miscommunicating important information.
Thanks, Liz. I'll do my best today to try to say PFAS for the large group and then spell out as you suggest. My next question I'm going to direct to Bob Buck. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great, thank you. Bob, is there a preferred online resource for a National Naming Convention's reference or a place to find a comprehensive list?
Yeah, KM, that's a great question. The PFAS, as we all know, are a universe of substances with very different properties, liquids, solids, gases, polymers, non-polymers. The references cited in the TEC reg document do provide naming conventions for everyone to use. And in particular, the Open Access 2011 paper that established the naming conventions and terminology for PFAS in the supplemental material, which is free and open to folks, it contains naming conventions and terms for numerous classes, groups, and subgroups, as well as individual names for over 200 specific substances, including their CAS numbers. However, there is not, regrettably, a national reference. It's really these references we've provided in the TEC reg document. A large group of stakeholders across many different dimensions, including regulators, industry and academia is working with the OECD PFAS workgroup to create an updated document on nomenclature and terminology for these substances to really take a good view of the current state of this and knowledge around the broad variety of substances that have been identified. Most particularly, though, as you stated at the beginning, it really is important that everybody try to use clear, specific, and descriptive terms and names when they talk about these substances. The term PFAS is really a very, 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 very broad term. So to the extent that you can use more specific terms, that's always helpful for who you're talking to and being clear about what you're talking about. Thanks, Kate Emma.
Great, thank you, Bob. So this next question, I'm going to direct it to Liz, and I think it would help if we took a look at the family tree again, please. Liz, can you please explain the differences between the non-polymer and polymer PFAS?
Sure. So the slide that you see here is directly from the tech reg. It's figure 2.2. And I'm going to start with the polymer side on the right. So polymers are large molecules that are formed by combining many identical smaller molecules in a repeating pattern. So you can kind of imagine connecting Legos together. And these polymer substances are very difficult to break down in the environment. So typical polymers in the PFAS family, as you can see here, include fluoropolymers, polymeric perfluoropolyethers, and side-chain fluorinated polymers. Non-polymer PFAS on the left include two major classes of chemicals, the perfluoroalkyl substances and the polyfluoroalkyl substances, and both of those include many subgroups of chemicals. So in explaining the main differences between the polymers and the non-polymers, it's important first to note that most compounds of interest at environmental release sites are the non-polymers. And the non-polymer PFAS are the ones which are most commonly detected in humans, biota, and other environmental media, not the polymer PFAS. And the non-polymer PFAS are the ones that probably have state or federal guidance values, and the laboratories are analyzing for the non-polymer PFAS. And finally, the polymer PFAS are believed to generally pose less immediate human health and ecological risk relative to some of the non-polymer PFAS. So I do encourage people to look at section 2.2 of the tech reg, but specifically look at figures 2.2 through 2.4 because they show some really good differences between the polymer and non-polymer PFAS and also provide a really great family tree for each class of chemicals.
Thanks, Liz. And you're right in mentioning the additional family tree that is in the technical and regulatory guidance document is actually much more expanded than what we're looking at on the screen right now. There's a number of different categories in there. I do have one follow-up question. I'm actually going to direct it to Bob. Bob, Liz just mentioned polymeric PFPEs or perfluoropolyethers. Are there also some non-polymer PFPEs?
Yes, indeed there are, and that more detailed family tree is a good anchoring point for folks to look at to see what some of those might be.
Great. Thanks, Bob. I'm going to have to ask this question, too. Could there potentially be a simpler naming convention for PFAS compounds? I mean, we have PFPEs in both categories, it sounds like.
Yeah, this is one of those where it's kind of hard, and unfortunately, you know, the naming conventions for these PFAS compounds are continuing to evolve, but they are all have individual names, and then they have group names, much like we're individuals and we can be gathered up into groups too. So it's really important that we be as specific and descriptive as possible whenever we talk about these things, and don't, we know that the PFAS substances are different, they don't behave the same. So they really do represent different groups, subgroups, and classes. So I think there may not be a simpler naming convention, but maybe we'll have to expand some of these names as we identify additional structural classes of these chemicals. Again, endeavoring to be clear and specific. And we'll, as we learn more about these substances and things get identified, we're going to need to create more. And we really want to avoid confusion and misunderstanding. So general terms, maybe I should recommend would be avoided. Try to get as specific and clear as you are able when you're identifying substances, groups, or subgroups.
Excellent. Thank you, Bob. The next set of questions are on the topics of sampling and analytical. I'm going to welcome Janice to the discussion. Are you there, Janice?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you. Janice, right now there are two EPA methods for analysis of PFAS in drinking water. Can you speak to what the biggest differences are between EPA method 537.1 and EPA method 533?
Sure. One of the biggest differences is the quantitation scheme that's used in the method. EPA method 533 uses a isotope dilution quantitation, whereas EPA method 537.1 uses an internal standard quantitation. So isotope dilution accounts for interferences caused by complex matrices and biases introduced in sample preparation and instrument issues, whereas internal standard quantitation only accounts for those interferences associated with instrument issues. So it does not account for the sample preparation bias. However, since sample matrices aren't typically expected to be complex when it comes to drinking water. You would hope it wouldn't be complex. The internal standard quantitation used in method 537.1 should be considered accurate as 533. Another big difference, of course, is the analyte list. Method 537.1 generally covers the analysis of most long-chain PFAS, whereas method 533 generally covers more of the shorter chain PFAS. So the methods preparation protocols and sampling and analysis protocols have been optimized for those particular analytes. So 537.1 has been validated for 18 compounds, whereas 533 has been validated for 25. So there's a total of 14 compounds that are included in both methods. So you have some overlap when it comes to the analytical, to the analytes in the methods. So you have four unique ones relative to 537.1, and you have 11 analytes that are included in 533 that are not included in 537.1. So those are the two real big main differences between the two methods.
Thanks, Janice. That certainly helps. I have a follow-up question to that. Chuck, are you on now? Welcome to the roundtable.
Yes, ma'am. KDEM, I am. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. Welcome. So just to follow up on what Janice just spoke about, can you address the benefits and challenges between the two approaches, the internal standard or the isotope dilution approaches?
Well, first, you know, internal standard approach is certainly a solid calibration approach. It's used in a lot of other analytical techniques that we're familiar with, like 8260 and 8270. But in that approach, we're using a small set of compounds, 2, 3, 4 compounds, and these are typically isotopically labeled compounds, just like in the isotope dilution. But they could be, they're chemically similar, but not necessarily exactly the same. And so they help to normalize the response of your compounds against the calibration curve that you established. But as Janice said, it really only monitors the goodness of an injection and the repeatability of the injection because it has nothing to do with the extraction. Plus, you've got a small number of compounds representing or being used with a larger number of target compounds. In isotope dilution, ideally, and it doesn't always work this way, but as much as is possible, we have a one-for-one matching between an isotopically labeled compound and the native compound. And these are the exact same compound other than its carbon-13 or deuterated form of your target compound. So it extracts the same, it chromatographs the same, and we also then add it to the sample prior to the extraction and take it through the entire extraction. And as Janice said, it allows us to do a concentration correction for our target analyte at the end of the analysis scheme. And that's why you oftentimes hear isotope dilution. You'll hear those compounds referred to as extracted internal standard, because they have some functionality like an internal standard in the internal standard calibration mode, except that they're taken through the entire extraction process and therefore can help do the concentration correction in your samples.
Thanks, Chuck. I appreciate that. And now that we're talking about analytical methods, Janice, if you could come back on, I have a question for you. About non-potable water analysis. So can the approved method that we're just talking about, like EPA method 537 or EPA method 533, can that be applied to sampling of a non-potable water sample, like from a groundwater monitoring well? In other words, what are the preferred analytical procedures for groundwater? I actually have an example here. The person writes, we have many instances where a site water supply well sample is analyzed using an EPA method, and everyone's been happy with those results. But there's been some skepticism about whether or not to use the same EPA analytical method for analyzing the samples from the monitoring well, even though the monitoring well is screened in the same water-bearing zone as the site water supply well.
Whoever answered that question has been listening in on many, many conversations lately. This has been becoming some of the great debate here on PFAS. The short answer is really it depends. There is no unequivocal yes, you can use it for groundwater samples. Drinking water methods are designed for the analysis of a set of specific PFAS. So we had the 18 for 537.1 and the 25 for 533, and they're optimized for a very clean matrix, sample matrix. So first, if all of your project analytes are not included in the scope of the drinking water method that you wish to use, you shouldn't use that drinking water method because that method has not been validated for that analyte. Next, you have to consider the well water's water chemistry. Drinking water methods do not contain elements that are needed to address matrix interferences caused by things like high organic matter or co-contaminants potentially. All high organic content and co-contaminants are encountered in non-potable water wells. These more complex matrices often require additional steps such as centrifuging your sample or cleanup procedures using cleanup cartridges or carbon cartridges that are not included in the drinking water method. So if you were to include those in the drinking water method, that's a modified method. It's not the drinking water method. It's not been validated. So because of this, drinking water methods are not recommended for groundwater wells in general. Now, groundwater wells that are used for drinking water sources should be relatively clean matrices. You would really hope that. So in some cases, you may be able to use these drinking water methods. But again, it's going to depend on if all the analytes that you need to look for are included in that method, and if that water in that well is clean enough to not have those problems associated with sample preparation, sample analysis due to matrix interferences. You should never assume that just because you have a drinking water source well that it's going to be clean enough that you can utilize a drinking water method. You should really investigate that and verify that prior to sampling. So some of the key elements that you need to evaluate with respect to laboratory procedures if you're testing non-potable water using a different method other than a drinking water method, would be whether, elements like whether the laboratory uses the entire sample that's contained in the container and also includes a rinse of that container or is an aliquot of the sample that was sent to the laboratory analyzed, whether the sample is extracted using a solid phase extraction cartridge or it utilizes a direct injection method. Did they include cleanup steps in their method that would help to eliminate some possible interferences? And also, investigate which quantitation scheme, like we were just talking about, is utilized. Are they using one that will account for both sample preparation and analysis bias, or are they using one that will not address the sample preparation bias? One of the biggest things that you really need to look for in all of the methods, regardless of what method you utilize for non-potable water, is that you need to have a robust set of quality control parameters. that you evaluate all these potential biases that can be associated with sample preparation and analysis. So that's really the biggest concerns if while you're trying to select a method, if you are not able to use a drinking water method for a water source, well, those are the things that you really need to consider.
Great. Thanks, Janice. And I guess I'm going to go back to Chuck here, too, since we're keeping on PFAS analysis. Chuck, what are some of the analytical challenges when analyzing for PFAS?
Well, I think probably one of the biggest analytical challenges for the analysis of PFAS, KDAMA, is that we don't have an EPA method yet to standardize our approach to non-potable water, solid material, tissues, and the like. So the work that's going on now to develop and validate a method like that is we're anxiously awaiting those results and to have something against which to standardize our applications. But in lieu of that, and to try and draw on some of the parameters that Janice was referring to, if we look at and use, when we consider standardization of methods, a laboratory that has a method, has a procedure that is compliant with the DOD, Department of Defense, their QSM, that's a Quality Systems Manual, which is a compilation of QA/QC criteria for a wide variety of analytical techniques. And within that Quality Systems Manual, there's a section of the document called Table B15, B as in boy, and that Table B15 has a list of QA/QC criteria that if your method or your laboratory's method can meet and comply with those criteria, you've got a good yardstick against which to compare the quality of the data that's going to be generated by that analytical technique.
Chuck, thank you for that feedback. Appreciate that. The next question I have, I want to direct actually to Jeff Wenzel. Jeff, welcome to our roundtable.
Hello, Kate Emma.
Hi. Jeff, what uses of PFAS have the greatest potential for exposure to PFAS?
Thanks for the question, Kate Emma. Our figure 2.1 gives an overview of the uses of PFAS and gives indications of when human exposures and or releases to the environment may occur. So with PFAS, exposures and risk assessment principles still apply just like any other contaminant. You have to have a release and an exposure for risk to occur. But as a general rule of thumb, we would assume that as we move down this list from PFAS production to manufacturing to industrial and consumer products, that there's some reduction in the risk of release into the environment and or human exposure. However, one could also assume that as you move down the list, the knowledge of PFAS could also be reduced. So individuals in production and manufacturing could have great practices and protocols in place to minimize or prevent releases and exposures. And some of the intended uses of PFAS are actually to release the product, like with firefighting foam. But again, with awareness and good protocol, releases and exposures can be minimized or prevented. The release mechanism is also important to consider for PFAS, like aerial deposition from foam from coating facilities, high volume releases of firefighting foam, or discharges to a sewer system from a plating facility. All could disperse and have different impacts to the environment and different exposures. And at the bottom of this, we have consumer products. And for the most part, consumer products are considered generally safe.
All right. Thanks, Jeff, for that. But I also want to go back to that because you just said that this is, you know, a general rule of thumb. Are there specific uses of PFAS that have caused the greatest exposure impact to the environment? Or maybe there's a little more information you could give us?
Yeah, thanks, Kate Emma. We spent a lot of time on the history and use team trying to answer this question or similar questions. There's a lot of variables to consider and questions to ask when trying to evaluate the potential environmental impacts and human exposures from PFAS, for which particular PFAS is involved, and how and when it was released into the environment are important to know. For example, a stable and soluble fluoropolymer such as polytetrafluoroethylene, PTFE, may pose little environmental or health risk once it's in a product, but significant environmental releases may occur if controls are not used during manufacturing when non-polymer PFAS are used to make PTFE. Releases may occur through manufacturing waste streams, fugitive emissions, spills, disposals of PFAS-containing or treated materials, or as I mentioned before, sometimes the intended use of the PFAS requires a direct release into the environment. The volume, concentration, and mixture of PFAS released into the environment varies based on the source, release mechanisms, environmental controls employed throughout the life cycles. But to better help a company or state or team answer this question, we developed Table 2-4. From personal experiences, through reviewing documents and other sources, the intent was really to develop a list of industries and applications that we were aware of using PFAS or having some release of PFAS. This table lists 19 industries or applications with historic or current uses. And then we follow that up with Section 2.6 to discuss some of the major releases to the environment from this list.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. There's a lot of great resources in the tech reg, so thanks for providing those links to the table. Appreciate that. Just as a reminder to folks that are participating today, if you keep coming up with more questions, please keep them coming into that Q&A pod on the bottom of the screen. We're certainly appreciative of the questions that we've received thus far today. The next question, I'm going to direct it to Chuck. Chuck, initial sampling protocols for PFAS sampling had restricted clothing, personal products, and equipment to a small list of approved products. How likely is it that sampling guidance or SOPs get revised to be less stringent in response to published data on PFAS and materials? For example, laundry dryer sheets, blue ice, sunscreen, bug spray, tin foil, tubing. I know the list can go on and on.
Yeah, Kate, I mean, that's a great question, and actually it's a great example of when you first start out in our scientific endeavors, when we first start out on something that we've only got a cursory amount of knowledge on, and then we start to realize the prevalence or the magnitude of the issue, our initial response is to you know, include lots of things, to probably overreact a little bit, you could argue, to the things that could potentially contribute to contamination of samples, and especially coupled with the fact that we're looking for PFAS at 1 and 2 ppt in water, nanograms per liter. So that's pretty low level. So you could argue it wouldn't take much to potentially contaminate a sample. But like with any, again, scientific process, and we talk about this in Chapter 11 with in sampling analysis section, but with any process, as you gain information, as studies are done, as people inquire, we have experiences with sampling events in the field, things that worked well, people share best practices, you know, professionals share best practices in media, just like what we're doing now. And then people learn from that, we start to become more comfortable and we realize some of those things that we were worried about or concerned about before maybe aren't as big a concern. So we start to back off of that and we start to revise and modify our SOPs. An example of that data that's being generated, our colleague Liz Denley is an author, co-author on a document that did a study and looked at common materials, common laboratory and field-used materials to see what kind of PFAS residuals. And we did see some detections, but they weren't alarming, but they were there. But it's that we use that knowledge base to move forward and revise our protocols to be more practical.
Thanks, Chuck. And I think actually, Liz, do you want to add anything? Chuck mentioned that you have worked on some studies to look into this topic.
Sure. Yeah, so the study that we did, you know, showed the potential for PFAS to leach off of different sampling materials used, and some examples being different types of tubing, aluminum foil, balers, field books, and even bentonite. And in general, when we did see PFAS, we saw really low levels of PFAS leaching off of these materials with a couple of exceptions. But the one thing that we did learn is that there can be variability in the results depending on the manufacturer, say, of the tubing, or maybe even the lot number for the same manufacturer. I mean, that could be due to process quality variability. So I always say, you know, equipment blanks will always be your best bet to make sure that your sampling materials are not contributing PFAS to your samples. And you can even collect equipment blanks before your sampling event, as well as during the event. And finally, I also think, you know, we need to use common sense. You know, in our study, it's really highly unlikely that your field book is going to be gone.
All right. Thank you, Liz, for that. I'm going to go to the next question for Janice as we're talking about field activities. Janice, how can I ensure that the water sent from the laboratory for field blanks is PFAS-free?
That's a good question. So really, the term PFAS-free is a project-defined parameter because it really, it directly relates to the screening and regulatory limits and target analytes of the project. So to ensure the water is of the quality needed for the project-specific definition of PFAS-free needs to be communicated to the laboratory prior to them shipping supplies to the field. So the laboratory must verify the water that's sent to the field prior to shipping so that it meets these requirements for the project itself. This is typically done through the analysis of an aliquot of this water. I recommend that a certificate of analysis for the PFAS-free water be required to be sent with the bottle order so that this report can be reviewed by the field team to ensure that it included all of the project analytes, and it also included all those analytes met the requirements relative to what is defined as PFAS-free for that project. So typically, you'll see it at, you know, maybe one-third the reporting limit for that project for each analyte, or one-half their limit of quantitation that's required. It just depends on the, like I said, the regulatory limits and the screening limits that are applicable for that project.
Thanks, Janice. Actually, I'm going to have you stay on, ask you another question, too. There is some evidence to suggest that sample labels contain PFAS. What are labs doing to address this? Has a suitable replacement been identified?
Yeah, so we haven't seen strong evidence to support that this is a huge issue. But to address the concern, some of the laboratories assess the labels that are used on the sample containers, and they continue this through an assessment program that includes the analysis of blanks of these labels. Keep in mind that unless your sample bottle is pre-labeled, and it requires to be submerged in your sample, that label should really never come into contact with your sample, right? So it really shouldn't have a chance to contaminate your sample. So another way to address this concern is if you have to take a sample and submerge the entire sample bottle in your sample, to request the laboratory send the label separately and do not pre-label the bottles that are being sent out to the field. So that way you can ensure that those labels will not have any effect on your sample.
Great. Thanks, Janice. So Chuck, I'm going to ask for you to weigh in on this. How prevalent is cross-contamination of samples in the field? And then is cross-contamination a concern in the labs with respect to sample prep and analysis procedures?
Great questions, Kate Emma. And cross-contamination, quite frankly, is always a concern. You always worry about that. But our empirical data, what we've seen from sampling events in the field, is that cross-contamination in the field does not happen very often. And when it does, or when we've seen evidence of that, typically maybe on equipment blanks and the like, it's because there was some sampling that was being done. It was pretty, frankly, it was a pretty hot sample or set of samples, so maybe unanticipated. But for most samples, and especially when you look at the drinking water methods, 537.1, a field reagent blank, we're very specific and very intentional about how that field reagent blank is prepared, taken out into the field, then transferred to another container out in the field. For every single location that you do a, you collect a sample and then brought back, I mean, we're very, you know, there's a lot of concern, a lot of care, a lot of consideration for sampling. That same thing follows through into the laboratory. We have separate laboratory, we'll have separate channels and paths for doing drinking water samples and channels and paths and equipment in which we're doing non-potable water samples and solid samples. So the possibility is always there, but the prevalence or the frequency with which it happens is not that frequent, unless, and you know, these are the situations that we can't predict, when you get into a sampling event and the folks doing the sampling, the client like just had no idea a particular location was as hot as it was. But in most cases, I think we laboratories and field samplers have the situation pretty well in hand.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. I appreciate that answer. And actually, I'd like to go back to Liz. Liz, I think we might have had some audio trouble from you in your last response. Can you just summarize your comments about the safety of field personnel and some of the work that you did, just in case we didn't catch the end of that?
Sure. So what I was saying at the end is, you know, I think that you need to use, you know, common sense when sampling, because during our study, for example, we did see PFAS when we analyzed the waterproof field book, but it's highly unlikely, you know, that your field book is going to be touching your sample. And as far as, like, sunscreens and insect repellents, again, use common sense. You're going to be wearing gloves when you're holding your samples. You get the sunscreen and insect repellent shouldn't be getting into your sample. I think safety of field personnel has to come first, and we can be careful enough not to get this stuff into our sample.
Great. Thanks, Liz. I appreciate that. Janice, I think this next question is for you. Should trip lengths really be required for PFAS projects? Are field or trip lengths needed for solid matrices?
Yeah, so we have the EPA drinking water methods that utilize essentially a reagent blank that's really seen as a trip blank that's required. And so you should be using them in those instances. But for other instances, you got to really think about, you know, what was the purpose of trip blanks, and they're typically used for more volatile compounds. And so the analytes that you're looking for using the current methods with LCMFMS aren't really the volatile compound PFAS. In the future, you may need to consider using trip blanks for other analyses, maybe possibly some GC mass spec PFAS analysis down the road or other samples. But for the current methods that you utilize, you really they're not considered to be needed as with respect to analytes being volatile. But if you want to use those trip blanks to evaluate the sample bottles and the water, the PFAS-free water that's being utilized in the field, that is recommended if you want to do it in that way and treat it as more of almost a sample supply blank, not necessarily what we consider a trip blank. But a lot of people tend to do that and err on the side of caution and just go ahead and include those as well, because there has been so many unknowns, and so many anecdotal situations that have been relayed. Most people are just go ahead and include the trip links, but as far as them being absolutely necessary, that's really not the case.
Great. Thanks, Janice. And I'm actually not going to let you go. I want to ask you another question. So is there any guidance for taking equipment blanks or rinse blanks on drilling equipment, something like on an auger or a drilling bit that might have been used to install a monitoring well that would eventually be sampled for PFAS? Do you think that these blanks are actually necessary?
Yeah, I think so. For all of the field QC that you could possibly have for your PFAS sampling event, equipment blanks are probably the most critical for you to use. They should be taken if there's any indication that supplies or equipment used for in drilling or anything else may contain PFAS. As with sample other sample collection material, if PFAS content is suspected, it should be verified through these rinse blanks every single time. Some of the sampling guidance documents that are mentioned in the tech reg document in our chapter 11 include recommended procedures for taking equipment blanks. But in general, a rinse of a piece of equipment, say a drill bit, soil, a shovel, or tubing, for example, is performed usually by rinsing the piece of equipment with PFAS-free water and collecting that in one of the sample bottle containers and sending it out to the laboratory. One of the things that you do want to make sure you do is collect the same volume of water for that equipment rinse as you do for the actual field samples themselves, so they can be comparable.
Great. Thanks, Janice. I think now I'm going to switch back over and ask Jeff for this next question. When were PFAS first used in industry or manufacturing?
Yeah, our history and use fact sheet, table 2-1, provides a timetable for discovery and manufacturing over time. Electrochemical fluorination is one of the first production methods of a PFAS. It was licensed in 1945 with commercial production in 1951. Bob, I know you're more familiar with this topic than I am. I wonder if you'd have anything to add?
Sure, Jeff. Maybe just going one step deeper and a little bit more specific as it shows on the chart. The first substances that were manufactured by that ECF process were perfluorooctanoic acid, PFOA, and perfluorooctane sulfonate, the sulfonate substance, and some of their derivatives. They were used in that time as fluorinated surfactants and applied in aqueous solutions and uses of aqueous solutions at the time.
Thanks, Jeff, and thanks, Bob, for that. I appreciate it. Jeff, can you tell us about, you know, when manufacturing started, but are PFAS still being made in the U.S. today? And I guess to that end, are they still being manufactured in the world?
Yes. Yeah, PFAS are still reportedly being made in the United States, but certain PFAS have been phased out of production. In the early 2000s, a major manufacturer of PFOS and PFOA and some related compounds stopped production of particular PFAS. Reportedly, most of these PFAS at the time were based on 8 carbons. Since then, it's reported that this manufacturer has switched to 4 carbon-based PFAS. This phase-out included 6, 8, and 10 carbon PFSAs and related precursors, as well as PFOA. Any new manufacturer or import of the PFAS phased out by this company would require a U.S. EPA review based on significant new use rules described in Section 2.4.2. It's based on the 2012 chemical data reporting effort. No company reported manufacturer or import of PFOS into the United States. I should note that reporting was required for quantities greater than 25,000 pounds. When this company stopped producing PFOA in the early 2000s, it's reported that manufacture of PFOA was continued by other domestic producers using fluoryl telomerization. Then between 2005 and 2015, there were 8 major manufacturers of PFOA that voluntarily stopped production of PFOA and some related chemistries. But just a few weeks ago, a new significant new use rule was signed by EPA that will address manufacture and import of certain long-chain PFCAs like PFOA and fluoryl alkyl sulfonates. So for further discussions of the significant new use rules, we've got information in Section 8. And Section 2.4 discusses many of the actions taken in the U.S. and globally to reduce production and work of alternative formulations.
Thanks, Jeff. And actually, you mentioned Section 8, and I think that's Chapter 8 of the Technical and Regulatory Guidance document. We will be focusing on regulations and a number of other topics from the guidance document in our future roundtables. And actually, we are getting some questions right now from the Q&A pod, and we appreciate those. Please keep them coming in. But some of those we're going to actually table for now until our future roundtables that go into things like site characterization, or AFFF, and again, those regulations. So my next question I'm going to direct to Liz. Liz, can you please explain what precursors are?
Sure. So if we can go back to that polymer and non-polymer slide, good. So as I mentioned earlier, the non-polymer PFAS include two major classes, the perfluoroalkyl substances and the polyfluoroalkyl substances. And those perfluoroalkyl substances have these fully fluorinated alkyl tails, so every single carbon is attached to fluorine. And these perfluoroalkyl substances cannot break down because of these really strong carbon-fluorine bonds. Now, the polyfluoroalkyl substances, on the other hand, are compounds that have a non-fluorine atom, like hydrogen, attached to at least one but not all of the carbon atoms. And because the polyfluoroalkyl substances contain this non-fluorine atom, like hydrogen, it creates this weak link in the carbon chain and makes these compounds less stable and more susceptible to biotic or abiotic degradation. So there's another slide if you could go to that shows the degradation of the precursors right here. Good. So what happens is these polyfluoroalkyl substances, they can form these perfluoroalkyl substances from a biotransformation process. And as a result, many polyfluoroalkyl substances are referred to as potential precursors that have the potential to be transformed into these perfluoroalkyl substances. And as I said earlier, those perfluoroalkyl compounds cannot be further broken down and are the ones that are persistent in the environment. So Section 2.2 of the TEC Reg describes this in more detail, and Figure 2.8, which you see here, provides an example of degradation of some polyfluoroalkyl precursors. So you see the fluorotelomer alcohols on the left, or the methyl and ethyl perfluorooctane sulfonamido ethanols on the right. And you can see the final products after degradation are perfluoroalkyl substances like PFOA and PFOS, PFOS.
Thanks, Liz. I appreciate that. And actually, I'm going to have you stay on. Ask you another question. Can you please explain the difference between polyfluoroalkyl substances and side chain fluorinated polymers?
Sure. So as you can see on this figure, the main difference between polyfluoroalkyl substances and side chain fluorinated polymers is that the side chain fluorinated polymers are polymer PFAS, while the polyfluoroalkyl substances are non-polymer PFAS. But they do have something in common whereby they are both precursors. So as we discussed, you know, the polyfluoroalkyl substances are non-polymer PFAS, and they have that non-fluorine atom in the carbon chain, and they are precursors because it can biotransform into the perfluoroalkyl compounds when that non-fluorine atom bond is broken. And as we said earlier, the polymer PFAS are harder to break down. And in general, polymers are not precursors to perfluoroalkyl substances, but the side chain fluorinated polymers are polymer PFAS that contain this non-fluorinated polymer backbone. So from which these fluorinated side chains branch off. And some of those fluorinated side chains which branch off may become precursors for perfluoroalkyl acids, like the polyfluoroalkyl substances, when that point of connection of the side chain on the polymer is broken, and the result will be breakdown into a perfluorinated substance. And again, section 2.2 again of the tech reg provides some examples of these types of PFAS and explains the polyfluoroalkyl substances and side chain fluorinated polymers in a little bit more detail.
Excellent. Thanks, Liz. And I think also figure 2.3 that goes along with that section can try to illustrate some of the categories of those polyfluorinated substances that are that you're talking about. My follow-up now is actually for Bob. Liz mentioned the side chain fluorinated polymers, but Bob, are all polymers other than those side chain fluorinated polymers precursors to PFAAs, that's the perfluoroalkyl acids? Are we only concerned about the side chain fluorinated polymers as precursors to the PFAAs?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And as Liz outlined, the side chain fluorinated polymers are really the focus of substances that have the potential or may turn into the perfluoroalkyl acids, the PFAAs. And it's because of that side chain. The way that I like to think about it is think of a comb, and the spine of the comb is this hydrocarbon polymer backbone, and those little tines perpendicular that are sticking off the comb's backbone, some of those are these chains that contain a perfluoroalkyl moiety, and it's the possibility of those chains being carved off by either abiotic or biotic mechanisms that leads to the concern about PFAAs. The fluoropolymers and the perfluoropolyether polymers are incredibly chemically stable, thermally stable, biologically inert polymers in general, and do not have the possibility to form PFAAs under their reasonably foreseeable use conditions.
Bob, thank you for that additional information. Liz, my next question is for you. Many PFAS have both acid and non-acid forms of the substance. The naming conventions are slightly different with two different CAS numbers, so CAS, the Chemical Abstract Service numbers, but they might have the same abbreviation. For example, perfluorooctane sulfonate, PFOS, and perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, also abbreviated as PFOS. So which form is more suitable to use when you're describing groundwater samples?
Thanks. Yeah, that's correct, and it can be confusing. So the PFAS compounds can have different CAS numbers for the same chemical, depending if you're looking at the acid, anion, or cation form of the chemical. And some don't even have CAS numbers. So PFAS are typically formulated as acids, but they're present in the groundwater and in humans in the anionic form. And that's where that slight difference in names comes from. So you could start with perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, the PFOS. But in water, the chemical is going to lose a hydrogen and turn into the anionic form, perfluorooctane sulfonate. So when you're looking up physical and chemical properties of these chemicals, it's really important to make sure you're looking at the properties of the right form of the PFAS chemical, because whether they exist as an acid, an anion, or even a salt, it's going to affect how they behave in the environment. And their properties could be really different for each form of the same chemical. So when we're describing the presence of these chemicals in groundwater, we should use the anionic form.
Okay, thanks, Liz. So Chuck, to follow up on that, what if the lab I'm using says that they're analyzing for the anions, but the lab report that I receive reports the acids?
Yeah, Kate, Emma, that's a great, I know we've said this several times, but it is a great question because it opens up a whole can of worms, actually, for folks, because we get so hung up on the fact that, and rightfully so hung up on the fact that there's a CAS number for the acid form, there's a CAS number for the anion form, and where there are salts, like an ammonium salt or a sodium salt, oftentimes there's a CAS number for that. So it's like, what exactly are we all talking about, right? Well, we report, the lab reports the acid form and that CAS number. what we physically analyze for is the anion. Physically in the instrument, and what we extract out of the water sample is an anion. And without doing a too deep a dive on the chemistry, that's because a value called the pKa for many of these compounds is so low that for all practical purposes, the pHs at which we do the analysis and at which they exist in the environment, that proton that makes it the acid is dissociated. So it exists as the anion. So we physically analyze, extract and analyze for the anion, but in our calibration schemes, our calibration models, remember before we talked about internal standard and isotope dilution, but those are basically calibration models. We put it in as the acid so that the values we generate are represented as the acid. So it's a matter of labeling and the mass amounts that we use represent the acid. You can convert between the two relatively easily. It's just a function of the molecular weight of the acid versus the molecular weight of the anion and the difference in those molecular weights. Well, in these cases that we're talking about, it's the difference of a proton, which is one, weighs one AMU, versus a compound that might have a molecular weight of 499 or something over 500. So you're looking at a ratio of 1 over 499. So if you think about that, that change or conversion, it is a conversion, but it's a really small one.
Thanks, Chuck. So Janice, you know, as someone who's looking at a lot of data and hearing what Chuck's saying, talking about the acids and the anions and the salts, so are the acids preferred for the results or are other forms of the analytes equally acceptable?
Well, I guess it kind of really depends on who you ask. But with respect to EPA methods and the DOD and most state regulations, they're put in terms of the acid. In that respect, you should be quantitating the acid. In the case of the DOD, we actually go a step further and explicitly prohibit quantitating the PFAS as their salt form. But if you look at all the regulations and the screening level criteria, the analytes are typically listed in their acid form.
Thanks, Janice. Chuck, can you please tell us what methods are available for analyzing PFAS in soil, in sediment, and in wastewater matrices?
Well, as far as EPA validated methods, we don't have any. That's part of the dilemma, but it's being worked on. But we've got, there's an ASTM method. I just dropped the number. Check the tech reg because we've got it listed there, but it's 7869, I think. I don't know why I'm being so dyslexic about that right now, but anyway, so there aren't, but EPA accepted methods. But if we go back to something that I mentioned before, and that is a framework or a system of QAQC, so if your laboratory, and I'm not trying to downplay the importance of having a standardized method. But the reality is, if you have a method that can conform to the QAQC criteria and practices as outlined in the DOD Quality Systems Manual, QSM, and within that document, and it's a large document, Table B15, then you've got some level of assurance of the quality of the data that's generated and the QC considerations that had to go into generating that information.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. And actually, Janice, do you know if there are any methods in the works for analyzing these other matrices?
Actually, there are. Okay, so what Chuck was talking about with no methods being, APA methods being published at this time, there is a draft of 8327, which is for non-potable water, that is out there. But, you know, we distinguish, when you read the TEC reg document, you'll see we make the distinction between finalized validated methods and draft methods. And that's because, you know, those things could change. Some significant elements of those methods could change in the future, and we don't know. So it's best just to focus on the finalized methods. So with that, in that respect, moving forward, you know, because we have this void that we need to fill with methods, DOD is funding through the CERTIP ESTCP program, the single and multi-lab validation of an isotope dilution method. This method's going to target 40 PFAS in a range of media. So it's going to include groundwater, surface water, wastewater, leachates, soil, sediment, biosolid, and tissue. Everything we possibly could think at. We're throwing the kitchen sink at it in analytes and media terms. So this method, what the DOD hopes to do is to validate this method, and following the single lab validation, submit it to the Office of EPA Office of Water for consideration as a 1600 series method. We also have incorporated comments from both Office of Water and the folks with the SW846 program to in hopes that in the future that this method will also be considered for as an SW846 method as well. In addition to that method, DOD is also, through the CERTIP ESTC program and NAVC, developing and validating some additional methods, but those methods are relative to the analysis of individual PFAS and total organic fluorine in the AFFF, the aqueous film-forming foam formulations themselves, and not environmental media. I also know that the EPA is also in the process of developing a total organic fluorine method for environmental media as well, and they're moving forward with that development currently. So there's a lot of methods that are in development that's going on and validation that's going on. So, you know, you can expect to see those external tables that are included in the TEC reg document, as well as the TEC reg document itself, to be updated accordingly as more finalized methods get developed and published.
Thanks, Janet. Sounds like there's a lot on the horizon. Looking forward to learning more as time goes on. My next question I'm going to direct to Liz. Jeff had actually talked, I think we'd heard a little bit before, about the fact that PFAS are still being made and used in the United States and around the world, but certain PFAS had been phased out of production and use. So Liz, can you speak a little more, please, about some of these replacement PFAS and how those might be related to looking for PFAS in the environment? Particularly, I guess, are there any new PFAS that maybe we should be looking at or looking for?
Sure. So, you know, because of all these concerns regarding the persistence, bioaccumulation, potential, you know, ecological and human health effects of these long chain perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA and PFOS, PFOS, manufacturers have developed these replacement short chain PFAS chemistries that will not degrade to the long chain perfluoroalkyl substances like PFOA and PFOS. And the short chain alternatives include short chain perfluoroalkyl substances like 4-carbon perfluorobutanoic acid or 5-carbon perfluoropentanoic acid as replacements to those long chain perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA and PFOS. Or it could include things like fluorotelomer-based products. And these products can degrade to form short-chain perfluoroalkyl acids, but they will not degrade into the long-chain perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA and PFOS, and those are the ones that have been causing the concern. So it is important that we're staying aware of the trend towards the shorter-chain chemistries as these replacement PFAS may be detected in the environment more and more. And as to your question on whether there are new PFAS that we should be looking at, I would say definitely yes, and that we are already doing that. So our labs are beginning to have capacity to analyze for some of these shorter chain replacements, EPA's method 537 currently has four common replacement chemicals used for polymer manufacturing, what we refer to as Gen X and also Adana, and also replacements for the metal plating industry. These F54 or EPA method 533 also contains some different replacement chemicals, including some used for firefighting foam, metal plating, surface treatment of food contact materials, and fluoropolymer manufacturing. And it includes chemicals like fluorotelomer sulfonates, perfluoroether compounds, and some shorter chain PFAS. So Section 2.4 of the TEC reg provides some more details on the phase out of the longer chain perfluoroalkyl substances and in the introduction of these replacement chemistries into products.
Great, thank you, Liz. And actually, Bob, if you would be willing to give us a follow-up on that, you know, Liz had mentioned HFPODA. I think that's what we hear about Gen X a lot. It's frequently mentioned as a replacement PFAS. Is Gen X a precursor of short-chain PFCAs, or those perfluorocarboxylic acids?
That's a good question. The Gen X, which as Liz mentioned, is known as HFPO dimer acid, hexafluoropropylene oxide, for those of you that like the chemistry terms. It's a substance that was created for a very specific use as a polymerization processing aid to manufacture certain fluoropolymers replacing PFOA. It has no other commercial use that I know of. It's only manufactured for that purpose, and it is not considered a precursor for perfluorocarboxylic acid.
Thanks, Bob. And actually, we have a question about the toxicity of Gen X or HFPODA. Also, some questions about toxicity of some of the other PFAS compounds. But we're going to be holding those until our future roundtable discussion about toxicity and risk assessment. So rest assured, we are going to get to that question, just not in today's session. But also, I'm also loving seeing all the questions that are coming in right now in the Q&A pod, so please keep them coming. And we're going to do our best to get to as many of those as possible. If they are about today's topics and we can't answer them today, we will be preparing our digest of questions and answers, and we'll make sure we can include that, and you can get access to that later on. The next question I'm going to ask of Jeff. Jeff, you mentioned earlier ECF. Can you explain why the TEC reg talks about the manufacturing differences between ECF and fluorotelomerization?
Thanks, Kate. It's a fun topic. It can help you learn a lot about your site and what's going on there. The ECF, for example, during that production, about 70% of what's made is linear PFAS. The other 30% branched for fluorotelomerization. It's even numbered carbons and linear PFAS. So it can tell you a lot about where the contamination came from, what process it's made, but also how it's going to move in the environment and act in the environment once it gets in there. Important part of the history, important part of the investigation.
Thanks, Jeff. And actually, Bob, you had added something before. Anything else that you could maybe add or feedback on ECF and fluorotelomerization?
Sure, maybe just taking a little step deeper. Jeff, thanks for the opportunity to do that. Again, as Jeff mentioned, the electrochemical fluorination process yields both odd and even number carbon substances, as well as linear and branched isomers. And what the branched means is it has the same number of carbon atoms, but in a different configuration. And that makes it a different substance. The fluorotelomer process, on the other hand, yields only even carbon number linear substances. So when you look at an environmental sample, for example, and I guess we're going to talk about this here in a minute, the presence of branched isomers are really an indicative sign of something that has an electrochemical fluorination origin.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you, Bob. Janice, let's stick with this, this thought about linear and branched PFAS and electrochemical fluorination, why is it important to consider branched and linear isomers in our analysis?
So you need to consider all branched and linear isomers primarily so that you're not underreporting the total concentration of a given PFAS. Like Jeff said, the branched isomers could account for up to 30% of a particular analyte. But the difficulty is that we don't have analytical standards consisting of branched and linear isomers for all PFAS for which branched and linear isomers may be present in a sample. But for those where we have an appropriate analytical standard, the chromatographic peaks representing the branched and linear isomers should be summed and reported as the total amount, so you do not bias load those results.
Thanks, Janice. And I actually have a follow-up question about linear and branched PFAS. I'm going to direct it to Bob. Bob, is there a typical naming convention to follow for linear branched PFAS? Most specifically, does the naming convention follow rules in IUPAC? I think that's the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry.
Yeah, who would have known there was a union for pure and applied chemistry? But there you go. The answer, just a little levity there. The answer is yes. The good news about all this is the naming conventions for organic substances, those things that are made from carbon, are well established. They've been around for hundreds of years now. Chemists kind of came up with them, and there's a very, very rigorous rubric for naming these things, and it's really critical because each one of them does have a different name, and this CAF number, which is sort of like in the U.S. your social security number, right? It's unique to that substance and allows you to identify it very specifically. So good news is there is naming convention, but what that means is, as we said earlier, there are lots of names. So you want to be mindful of that as well.
Thank you, Bob. I have a question here on some of the sources. So, Jeff, which type of plating operations use PFAS in their processes besides chrome plating? And is there any information about what PFAS are used in the plating operations?
Thanks, Kate, Emma. So a little bit of history about the question. So PFOS have been used as a mist suppressant to prevent air emissions of toxic metal fumes during the plating process. Toxic metals, typically talking about hexavalent chromium. So chrome plating is the most significant plating operation with a history of using PFAS. However, PFAS could be used in nickel, cadmium, or lead plating, metal plating on plastic, and alkaline zinc plating. Some countries have phased out the use of PFOS in some electroplating operations and are adopting the use of fluoral telomers such as 6,2-FTS in the hard chrome plating operations. Or in the decorative plating, they're changing their operations to use a less toxic trivalent chromium rather than hexavalent chromium. F-53 and F-53B have been used in place of PFOS in metal plating operations in some locations. Significant new use rules allowed for continual low volume use of some PFAS in metal platings for a while, but that's no longer allowed.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. I'm going to go back over to Chuck for our next question. Chuck, sometimes our aqueous samples are really turbid. How should an aqueous sample with a large amount of sediment in it be handled in the laboratory? And more particularly, does turbidity impart matrix interferences?
Well, Kate, Emma, first let me state for the record for the questioner that we laboratories, we love turbid samples. Actually, no, we don't like turbid samples because they're...
Okay.
They impart difficulties into the analytical process. But yes, turbid samples can provide provide quote unquote interferences, because when we talk about interferences consist of basically anything that doesn't allow you to conduct your analytical process like you need to be able to conduct it, right? So if you can't draw the same volume of water through an SPE cartridge, if it presents some other organic that's present that is co-extracted, if it gives some other imparts some chromatographic problem or an ion response issue, those are all interferences. So yes, they can have a negative impact. So in the laboratory, and I think this is the turbid sample is a really good example to sort of reach back to a question that you had of Janice, where a site, I think in that situation, the site was doing some drinking water analyses, but then off-site that wasn't the actual drinking water supply, not using the drinking water analysis for those quote-unquote non-potable, even though they were part of the same aquifer samples. And some of that can do with the turbidity. And so the isotope dilution method is a really good application in turbid samples, because the best way to handle those is to add your isotopic labeled standards to your sample, agitate it so it's mixed well, and then centrifuge that sample. So you centrifuge it, get the sediment to the bottom of the container, and decant off the liquid. You do a rinse in there, re-centrifuge it, and then decant that and combine, and then you can get full volume. Once you remove those solids, you can get full volume through, and you've got a measure of any losses as a result of that centrifugation step. The other thing that I just want to add would be that we typically stay away from, unless there are some extreme situations or a client specifically wants to see that, we try and stay away from filtering samples. I know for other methods, field filtration is commonly used, but in this case, number one, we certainly don't want to do that in the field, because that means we're exposing the sample to the greater potential for contamination due to its environment. And then number two, the filter material, there are some presentations and publications that have shown that certain filter materials like nylon actually have a negative bias on certain PFAS compounds, like the sulfonic acid, some of the sulfonic acids. So filtration, unless absolutely needed because of some unique characteristic of the sample, should be avoided. Centrifugation is the way to go to handle the turbid samples.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. I appreciate that. Bob, I'm going to go to a question. Actually, we received this one before today, so along with the registration. And I think we might have a slide that can help us out here. Bob, the introduction to the TEC reg provides a definition for PFAS from an open access paper prepared in 2011, with you as one of the authors. And the definition says that all PFAS contain within their molecular structure a straight or branching chain of carbon atoms in which one or more of the carbon atoms has fluorine atoms attached at all bonding sites not occupied by another carbon atom. And the fluorinated part of the molecule can be expressed as shown on the slide. Is this definition universally accepted?
Yeah, this is a really good question. It goes back to something we spoke about earlier. Probably maybe just a little background, and the answer is no, but I'll tell you why. It's important for everybody to understand that the definition as it was created in 2011 was really focused on the concerns at the time around PFOA and PFOS and their homologs and substances that were related to them, could degrade into them as potential precursors and things like that. So the definition was really, really focused on substances that fit that description, and hence the word aliphatic as an example, a linear, you know, these carbon chains without a lot of double bonds in between the carbons, and explicitly excluding a number of substances, including things like aromatic carbon compounds that contain carbon-fluorine bonds, many of which are pharmaceuticals and pesticides that are really well and widely regulated. But as we mentioned earlier, since that publication, golly, it's almost 10 years now, right? As we mentioned also here in the the seminar today, there have been a large number of additional substances identified that meet the original definition and come close to it. So as we said, the OECD work group is reconsidering this and saying, how broad do we want to go in the consideration and inclusion of things that have carbon-fluorine bonds, and how useful is that? And that's something that's continuing to evolve, as we mentioned earlier.
Thanks, Bob. And actually, you just mentioned pharmaceuticals and pesticides, but what about refrigerants? So are refrigerants that have potential to be greenhouse gases, are they considered PFAS? I know sometimes they're referred to as PFCs.
Yeah, the PFCs in the day, that acronym doesn't mean private first class. For those of you that know folks in the military, it means perfluorocarbon. And when the ozone hole was originally discovered over the Antarctic and the discussion about ozone depletion and greenhouse gases came up, that acronym was applied to perfluorocarbons, and they're the most ultimate kind of perfluoroalkyl substances because all they've got is carbon and fluorine, that's it. However, a lot of the newer refrigerants that have replaced some of those things or replaced things that could turn into those perfluorocarbons actually were excluded and have been because, again, as the pharmaceuticals and the pesticides, that whole framework of chemicals and their uses and their properties since the Montreal Protocol with the Kigali Amendment is really well regulated and has very firm structures of regulatory assessment and approval for those substances and hence was set aside. Now in the more current dialogue and broader discussion, there's a push to now include more and more of these substances by some people in the regulatory community in parts of the world. We're going to have to see how it all plays out. But PFCs as an acronym, perfluorocarbons, that's what the acronym should and does mean. And yes, those substances are PFAS. Other refrigerants, perhaps not, depending who you ask.
Great. Thanks, Bob. So it sounds like this is, you know, an ever-emerging topic when it comes what PFAS are. Jeff, I have a question I'm going to direct to you, please, about sources. Can you please provide information about the use of PFAS in firefighting foams?
Yeah. So PFAS are still used in certain firefighting foams, specifically some Class B firefighting foams. Designed for extinguishing flammable liquid hydrocarbon fires. They're used in vapor suppression, and these can be major sources of local PFAS releases into the environment. Our Chapter 3 of the TEC reg document addresses this issue a lot more than the history and use document did.
Thanks, Jeff. And actually, we do have a number of detailed questions about AFFF. And like you said, Chapter 3 in the Technical and Regulatory Guidance document talks about AFFF. But we're going to defer these to our future roundtable discussions, these particular questions. And we hope you'll join us so we can talk a little bit more with other experts about the world of PFAS containing firefighting foam. But Jeff, before you go, so, you know, other than AFFF and maybe the use of AFFF at fire training areas, can you speak to maybe what some of the most common uses of PFAS have been or continue to be in industry?
Yeah, thanks, Kate Emma. I spoke about our figure 2-18 in section 2.63 before about, table 2-4, about the 19 industries and applications. These include aviation and aerospace, automotive, biocides, building and construction, cable and wiring, cosmetics and personal care products, electronics, energy, firefighting safety, food processing, household products, medical products, metal plating, oil production, mining, paper and packaging, PFAS production, semiconductors, and textiles, leather, and apparel.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Chuck, a question for you. what are the screening and qualitative techniques for PFAS analysis?
Well, let's before I give you the list of them, let's talk about what do we think we mean by screening and qualitative. And we do outline that in Chapter 11 towards the end of the section about the screening and qualitative techniques and have them listed there. But to contrast with what we've been talking about so far for most of our, what Janice and I have been going back and forth, 537.1, 533, you know, the methods that are being developed, 8327, like those are all targeted compound analyses. So you have to know what you're looking for going into it and then have analytical standards exactly for the exact compound, and then at the end you get quantitative numbers for all of those. Qualitative techniques are ones in which we're saying, and this applies very appropriately to PFAS, in which we're saying, I think there's more than these targeted compounds, and we know that. There's plenty of references that show many more PFAS compounds potentially in the environment than what we're actually able to analyze for. So how do we get a handle on those? There are some screening techniques, screening and qualitative techniques, like combustion ion chromatography, which looks at the fluorine content of an organic compound. So we basically take a sample, you combust it, completely mineralize it, and then analyze that combusted effluent for fluoride anion, and then associate that back to PFAS, try and draw a correlation to PFAS. And if you think about it, there might have slight high biases with that kind of a number. PIGI, the acronym stands for Particle-Induced Gamma Emission Spectroscopy. This is also another technique that looks at fluorine. It's pretty much a surface phenomena, and it uses, it's not generally available. It's currently done only at, I believe, only at the University of Notre Dame in Graham Peasley's lab, but I know that he has been working under a CERTA grant to design a field portable unit for that very purpose. Likewise, we've got something called the TOP assay that I think folks are familiar with, total oxidizable precursors. So what Liz talked about before with precursors, we've got a laboratory way in which we can take some of these precursors that we might not have analytical standards for and convert them to compounds that we can analyze for, and then use that as a correlation for the PFAS that's present that we can't specifically analyze for all the individual compounds. And then lastly, a screening or qualitative technique would be QTOF, or the quadrupole time of flight mass spectrometry. And by this technique, we can really go and just shortly say, look at, it's a non-targeted analysis. So we get a broader picture of what compounds are in the in a particular sample, and with that can start to narrow it down with the exact mass that's generated by that analytical technique. We can narrow that down to at least identify ones that have fluorine or other chemical, specific chemical functionalities. So then we can start to sort through this larger gamish of compounds that might be present in a sample.
Thanks, Chuck. And actually, a follow-on question that just came in a little bit ago that talks about PIGI that you just mentioned, and that measures, you mentioned total fluorine. Is it a useful tool for quantifying contamination, or should it be used to confirm the effectiveness of remedy implementation?
I don't know that it would be as useful yet, and I'm not an expert on PIGI, but as useful yet for quantifying the contamination. It can indicate contamination or the potential that there's contamination there, and it can show presence, absence. A lot of the work that Graham Peasley's lab is doing with PIGI is to try and improve the technique so that we can get down to lower concentrations. And he's done a lot of work, some of it under the CERTA grant, to do that very thing. But one of the limitations for Piggy for a while was we were typically looking at concentrations in the ppb range as opposed to the ppt or the part per trillion range. So we had several orders of magnitude difference there. So while it seemed like it could be very useful for those two things, quantifying contamination or remedial effectiveness, it looks at it at a substantially higher concentration, so it might not necessarily be appropriate to correlate. But there's a lot of work going on in his lab to do that very thing, to bring those concentrations down, and that it may be able to get to a point to be used for those end objectives.
Great. Thanks, Chuck. Actually, it sounds like there's a lot of work on this on the horizon, too. Janice, do you want to follow on to what Chuck was just talking about at all?
Yeah, no, that was a really good question, and I'll broaden it out to some of the other techniques that are used for, you know, not just Piggy, but any other total organic fluorine analyses. Right now, you know, they're thought of as techniques that are qualitative to some extent. So really, typically what you're seeing now, they're not used with respect to any, obviously, regulatory requirements, but the point where they're most helpful right now is looking at the remediation techniques and, you know, determining the processes needed for those remediation techniques. So if you have a DAC system or an ion exchange system, you know, you need to know what your load is going on of PFAS going into those columns so that you can see when you would possibly calculate roughly when you would need to change out those systems. So that's when, you know, techniques like Piggy or a total organic fluorine method would really be useful to give you some kind of estimate to capture, you know, more of the PFAS concentration so you can make a better determination for those change out protocols.
Thanks. And Janice, is there anything else you can expand on too, I guess, you know, thinking about some of these maybe field screening methods that we might be able to use?
Yeah, everybody wants a whole bunch of field techniques right now for PFAS. It would be wonderful to have a whole bunch of really quick, maybe down and dirty estimate techniques to provide you with a quick estimate of PFAS, or maybe some quick individual analyses for individual PFAS in the field. As far as that's concerned, there are currently available very limited techniques. The techniques that are out there, for the most part, a good number of them have not been validated for their intended use. As with respect to detection techniques, you know, a quick screen for the potential for PFAS to be present in a sample at a really high concentration that's often employed is just a simple shake test of your sample. So basically, this goes on the principle that if an aqueous sample foams when it's shaken, then there's surfactants such as PFAS in that sample at relatively high concentrations. If there's historic use of PFAS-containing materials such as AFFF at that site, then the foaming is usually assumed to be due to the fluor surfactants. But it also has to be kept in mind that there's other surfactants that could cause the foaming as well. So it's not necessarily a definitive indication that fluor surfactants are present. In development is also a field deployable size of that of Piggy, which is what one of the techniques that Chuck just mentioned. That is currently undergoing method validation, and you know, we hope that would be a great tool to have out in the field as for a quick analysis, because there's very little prep that's needed with respect to especially solid samples. One that I know of also that's undergoing validation through the ESTCP project program is a mobile lab-based LC-MS/MS screening method, and that would be used for detection and quantitation of individual PFAS and aqueous and soil samples. A quick screen for the potential for PFAS to be present in a sample at high concentrations that's often employed, you know, it would be, you know, would be great to have out in the field. You know, it's not something that you could make definitive judgment on concentrations, but it would help guide you in the direction that you need to go as far as to delineate your site.
Great. Thanks, Janice. I appreciate all of that. Bob, next question for you. Could you please explain where coatings made from PTFE, we know a common brand name of that is Teflon, but where does PTFE fall in the family tree? Yep, great, and thanks for flipping to that slide too. That helps.
Yeah, there in figure 2.2 in the upper right-hand corner is the box that says fluoropolymers. And PTFE is a fluoropolymer. It's a high molecular weight plastic, highly chemically, thermally stable, it's biologically inert. So it falls in that upper right-hand box.
So Bob, so if one were to be using, you know, these raw fluoropolymers, so like PTFE, for a coating, can that contain other PFAS, or is it only containing and just what it says, PTFE, and that's it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The answer is yes, it can contain other fluorinated substances. As we mentioned earlier, many fluoropolymers, but not all of them, are manufactured using processing aids. And those processing aids are generally non-polymer, either perfluoroalkyl or polyfluoroalkyl substances. We mentioned HFPO dimer acid, that's perfluoro. Adona was mentioned earlier, that's polyfluoro. We also know that depending on the processes for making those fluoropolymers, that there can be trace levels of other non-polymer fluorinated impurities that are present in them. Most people that know polymerization know that you may have unreacted monomers. You may have some side products that get formed, and those are important things to know about in fluoropolymers.
Great, thank you, Bob, I appreciate that. Janice, I'm gonna bring you back for our next question. Are there any proficiency tests for PFAS that are currently available? Janice, I'm not sure if you heard the question.
There we go. I got it. I'm sorry.
Oh, you're
I
back. Okay, great.
On my side.
excellent.
No, sorry about that. No, proficiency tests do exist currently that apply to some programs such as MELAC or the DoD ELAP certification program, and they've existed since about 2017. These are PT programs for drinking water, non-potable water, surface water and soils. They're run typically twice a year and are conducted like many of the other environmental parameters for which there have been PT programs for many, many, many years. The analyte lists do vary from PT to PT. And additionally, there are programs in other countries like Australia's NMI program for which, you know, anyone here can also participate.
Thanks, Janice. I have another question for you, too. We have a couple questions about this that we've received before with registration and today. Has there been any progress on analysis of PFAS in either air samples or analysis of volatile PFAS?
Yeah, this has become a hot item these days, you know, given that there's been a lot of interest in incineration processes, especially, and their potential byproducts when you're incinerating something that has PFAS in it. Yes, currently the EPA Office of Research and Development in Research Triangle Park is developing sampling and analysis procedures for PFAS in ambient air and emissions testing. So it's my understanding that, you know, they're going to have a sampling protocol, a sampling train protocol out, you know, in the near future. And that's obviously something that everybody's really been interested in. And, you know, going forward, you know, you can expect to see evaluation of, you know, not only some of the PFAS that we're typically used to looking for, but more of the volatile ones using, you know, maybe a GC mass spec analysis, and also including, you know, non-target analysis, because, you know, there's a lot to be learned on the PFAS that are actually present in these air samples, And so there's a lot of work to be done on it still, but EPA is making really good progress on that.
Thanks, Janice. The next question is for Jeff. Jeff, can you speak to how significant mixed waste landfills, or Subtitle D landfills, they're municipal solid waste, also known as MSW landfills, how significant are these as a PFAS source?
It's going to vary. So how significant a source a landfill is, if it's a source at all, is going to depend on variables like what kind of waste the landfill receives, like industrial waste versus consumer products, the age of the landfill, if the landfill is lined or not, how the leachate is treated, and what type of landfill cap is used, if any.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. So I guess a lot of work that we have to do to look into see the significance of any given site, I guess, not just our landfills. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to add that. I just wanted to add that EPA STAR grant was just issued to New York Department of Health to evaluate this question. So there is more work being done.
Okay. Excellent. Thanks, Jeff. Janice, I'm going to go back to you right now. Let's see. Sorry, I'm just trying to find the next question here. What is the effect on, and actually maybe, excuse me, I think I'm going to send it to Chuck. Janice, we'll give you a second here. But Chuck, what is the effect on PFAS results if samples are received outside the required temperature?
Well, one of the first and most important things are the PFAS analysis that you're having done, are they on a drinking water sample, and is it a compliance drinking water sample? Because if the answer is yes to those questions, then the effect of the elevated temperature or temperature outside of that range is you've got an invalid sample, because that's not the way the method is written. It's very specific and prescriptive about the receipt temperature of the sample. Now, outside of that, so you've got a non-potable water, wastewater, or solids that you receive outside of temperature. Well, you know, sort of conventional chemistry thinking would be these are forever chemicals, right? So it probably shouldn't have much of an impact. But we have seen some data and some results and presentations that have indicated that some of the precursor compounds that, again, back to what Liz had referenced and answered on before, that there is some degradation of precursor compounds, and in that degradation, they can form some of the perfluorinated forms, the perfluorocarboxylic acids, for example. So the concern would be that if you receive a sample outside of the expected or required temperature, and then you proceed with analysis, even though it's a non-potable water for which there isn't a stipulated EPA method or a soil that there isn't a stipulated method yet, the concern would be that you might have potentially elevated results for some of the perfluorinated compounds because of some of the biotransformation that could potentially occur with your polyfluorinated forms. So it's best to play it safe and get a new sample.
Thanks, Chuck. And actually, Janice, do you have anything that you might want to add regarding the temperature of samples as they're received?
I have a future stay tuned comment. So that the isotope dilution method that I spoke of that the DOD is currently validating, those studies include 90-day hold time studies for the matrices that are included in that method. So we're hoping that we'll have some good information moving forward on, true hold times for these 40 compounds moving forward. So basically, stay tuned. There has been some really good studies that have been published for some matrices, not all, but there's more to come in the future.
Excellent. Thanks, Janice. I'm going to go back to Jeff for this question. Jeff, what do we know about which PFAS are used in cosmetics and personal products?
Thanks. This is an important question for a lot of us. Individuals are concerned about their own personal exposure to products, and then those of us out collecting samples are concerned about cross-contamination. But as speakers said earlier, little concern about cross-contamination. Really, the most important thing is to protect our field crews who are going out and letting them use the insect repellent and sunscreen and other products that are going to protect them. But to get to the question, Table 2-4 of our tech reg identifies a few types of cosmetics and personal products that might have PFAS in them or PFAS used in their production, like for polymers, dental floss, and micropowders used in creams and lotions. Non-polymers have cosmetic shampoos, nail polish, eye makeup, denture cleaners. As for which particular PFAS are used in cosmetics or personal care products, that's much harder to answer. There appears to be relatively limited information in the public realm about which PFAS are used in which products. MSD list and ingredients list may be of very little help, and companies can claim that this is proprietary information. For more information, you can check out references in Table 2-4. We know this is an important topic for our readers, so we will continue to research sources and try to provide better information in further releases.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. Let's see. I think I have my next question, directing to Janice. Janice, are you aware of the timetable for US EPA approval or issuance of method 8327 or other methods for use with other media? Janice, you might still, I'm not sure if you heard that question. You may also still be on mute.
Yeah, I know I was having a little trouble with my audio. I'm sorry.
Excellent.
No, it's my understanding that the EPA is anticipating finalizing 8327 and publishing that in the fall of 2020. It's also my understanding that the method that the DOD plans to submit for the Office of Water for consideration as that 1600 series method is the basis for what is currently being described as method 8328 by the EPA. So as I said earlier, that method is currently undergoing single laboratory validation. And I really can't give you a timetable on when that's going to be finished because, you know, the current situation with COVID kind of slowing down the progress of a lot of our initiatives, it's a really difficult thing to kind of give an accurate estimate on when that method's going to be ready for prime time, so to speak.
Great. Thanks, Janice. I appreciate you trying to give us an answer on that one. we are coming up on 4 o'clock Eastern. We have a few more minutes, so I'm just going to try to get to a few questions, and then we'll be wrapping up. So question now I have is for Jeff. Jeff, are PFAS used in hydraulic fracking in the oil patch?
We get that question a lot. We also get questions about oil production and mining. For oil patch, we looked into it and found where non-polymer PFAS-containing products were marketed for use in oil well productions, so there may be instances. We found no indication of widespread or regular use in oil and gas well production. For oil production, we found some evidence of it being used in lining of gas pipes. And for mining, we found instances of it being used as surfactants during the ore, in ore mining during the flotation process.
Thank you, Jeff. And I know there are some references for that in Chapter 2 of the guidance document. Chuck, this question is for you. Are Teflon pump seals and tubing a potential source of PFAS compounds?
Well, Kate Emma, the short answer is yes, they're a potential source. It's not a definite, but yes, they are. And as an example of that, I'll just give you the example that in the laboratory, and early on we talked about the potential for cross-contamination, but, you know, contamination within the laboratory. Early on, I'm going to say 10 years ago, when we first started doing PFAS analysis, a lot of us took our LC-MS/MS systems that we maybe were using for some other kind of application and then started trying to do PFAS analysis. And we found in many cases we had a consistent background of PFAS, oftentimes for the C4, the C5 acids. And as we dug into this a little bit further, you know, we suspected our solvents and all that, but as we dug into it a little bit further, we found that there were components inherent in the LC portion of the LC-MS/MS that were fluorochemical polymers, and they were leaching some PFAS, some of these PFAS surfactants, into the analytical system. As soon as we changed out those parts to something that was non-fluorochemical based, like PEEK, the polyether ether ketone type polymer, our background went away. So that same kind of thing applies to the question about Teflon seals and Teflon tubing. So wherever you can, you need to stay away from those materials unless you're going to try and incorporate a really rigorous system of analyzing blanks, field blanks, equipment blanks, blanks collected at a frequency so that you can sort of track and monitor if there are any contributions. But when you start to think about all of that, really the easiest is to go to equipment that does not contain Teflon.
Thank you, Chuck, for that. Janice, a question for you. What needs to be considered when reviewing and validating PFAS data?
In addition to what the typical elements that you would review and validate with other data for other analytes, there are some additional elements that you need to consider relative to PFAS. There's an EPA published document that can assist in data review, not validation, but data review. These things are two totally different things. There's also published EPA validation guidance for drinking water data generated in accordance with Method 537. So that's relative to EPA guidances that have been published. DOD's also published data validation guidelines for data for all media other than drinking water that's generated in accordance with that Table B15 of the DOD QSM that Chuck's been speaking about. All of these documents you can find references to in the TechReg document.
Great. Thanks, Janice. And actually, I have a follow-up question on this. I'm going to send it to Liz from the audience just recently. Is it the responsibility of the sampler to specify which PFAS should be reported by the laboratory, or is there a standard list associated with the analytical method? And to keep going with that, if the sampler needs to specify, how does one determine what to request?
That's a great question. So the sampler obviously needs to work with their project. Really need to first understand what the data quality objectives are, what the project objectives are. You know, what are you trying to determine? Why are you collecting the sample? Is it just to show the absence, presence of only regulated PFAS above a certain level? Do you want to know more about the presence of other PFAS because maybe you're installing a treatment system? Are you trying to do some kind of forensics or source identification? And also, you know, what are the regulatory requirements? Because some states have very specific required PFAS lists. You know, the state of New York requires 21 different PFAS. Michigan has a list of 28 different PFAS. And Wisconsin, for example, has a list of about 36 PFAS. So it depends on a lot of different things, but it shouldn't be the responsibility of the sampler per se, but of the project team should decide, you know, with their data quality objectives, what exactly, which list exactly they need.
Great, Liz. Thank you for that feedback. I appreciate that. Chuck, I have a question for you. What kind of septa do you find has low PFAS interference, and do you have any recommendations along those lines?
Well, polypropylene septa or caps that are made of polypropylene are certainly, from our experience, PFAS-free, and in fact, you know, polypropylene is one of the accepted materials for sample containers, so there's some consistency there. But the reality is we've seen many different manufacturers that are, and this goes to what, you know, will seem somewhat in conflict with what I said before, but that are Teflon line septa, in which those septa are clean. We've done tests where we expose them to solvents for a period of time, and then concentrate that solvent down and analyze it, and it's fine. And then there are other ones in which we'll see detections, typically again of a C4 or a C5 carboxylic acid. So it just really depends. You need to be vigilant in testing and assaying your product, your materials, and I would argue that you can't always take it for granted, because if we think about manufacturing processes, oftentimes, you know, a manufacturer or a supplier of a given product, they have multiple suppliers that they're using also. So depending on their need, their volume needs, the QAQC at the time, you could see some variation in product. So, and sorry for the long answer, but really just comes around to you need to be vigilant in testing and let the empirical data rule. But certainly polypropylene has been pretty rugged.
Great. Thanks, Chuck. And I think I actually have one more question for you before we go. Should the sampling technique for PFAS be similar to sampling for low-level mercury? In other words, clean hands, dirty hands. Or should that not matter?
I think our experience to date has been, and this sort of goes back to the question you had for me earlier about cross-contamination and seeing essentially how that has evolved for us since we started on many of these projects. We were very strict and very rigorous about how we did things, almost too strict. I shouldn't have said rigorous, but too strict in how we did things. And as we gained information, we realized that while this is in lots of other products, as long as we're prudent in our practice and our sampling practice, and to what Janet said, as long as a container with a label on it isn't being dipped down into the water, but in fact it's being dispensed into the container, and you take some common sense approaches like that, I'm not convinced that the mercury sampling, the clean hand, dirty hand technique is really necessary. I think it's probably a little bit overkill for what we need here.
Excellent. Thanks, Chuck. Just looking at the time here, I know that we're wrapping up right now. And I think what we'll do is we have a number of other questions. And like I said before, we will try to get to those in our Q&A digest. I think we're going to bring today's roundtable discussion to a close for now. So thanks very much to all of you participants for your questions today and for staying with us for the past 2 hours. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us, and we hope that this was valuable for you. A very special thank you to our panelists for sharing their expertise and for their contributions to the ITRC PFAS team. So just as a reminder, on our website, we have the guidance document, a series of fact sheets and supporting documentation, and 10 training video modules that are on the content of the guidance document. You can access those from our home screen and head to YouTube to watch those. We also now have a risk communication toolkit that's available for your use on that PFAS page. If you're looking for more information, this is a quick reference on this slide that demonstrates an overview of the topics covered in the guidance document. You can get to that guidance document not only as a web-based format, but also you can download it as the entire PDF. There are also those 12 external files that we have for you to download with additional information associated with the topics in the guidance document, such as the regulatory values for PFAS in water and soil, and a table that summarizes different analytical methods. As you heard today, the IPRC PFAS team plans to update the guidance document over the next year and a half. The new work that's underway includes writing a surface water quality section, updating and republishing the fact sheets into shorter four-page versions, and addressing, you know, some of the topics and emerging information that we heard from some of our panelists today. So with that, thank you so much for your participation today. As a reminder, if you've submitted a question that isn't addressed in the current document, we will try to consider that going forward in the upcoming revisions and in our upcoming roundtables. If you'd like further clarification on some of the answers that we discussed today, or if you'd like to ask even more questions, please feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org. We are planning to issue that digest of responses to today's questions and any of the follow-up questions in the next few weeks. We'll hope that you'll join us for our roundtable session 2, which is planned for October, when our expert panelists will answer your questions about site characterization, physical and chemical properties, and fate and transport of PFAS. The schedule for the additional future sessions will be confirmed soon. And with that, here's a link to the feedback form. As I mentioned earlier, this is a new format for ITRC, and we'd really love your input. Please use the form to also provide any questions you might have for our future roundtable sessions. Thanks again for joining us. I hope you all have a great afternoon.